this morning will be Lindquist Ford against Middleton Motors. If your plan is to put up text that's already in your brief, I suggest that you take it down. If you have charts, maybe, but much easier for judges to read what's in the briefs.
All right.
Mr. Steichen.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Steichen, and I represent the appellant, Middleton Motors, Incorporated. Now, we've presented a number of issues in the brief, including going to summary judgment, as well as errors at the trial, errors with the damages issues. What I would like to address is that there are two separate and independent grounds upon which the court can and should reverse the judgment and enter summary judgment for Middleton Motors. The first is that at the very beginning of negotiations, before the parties had entered into any substantive negotiations, the parties entered into a contract that was entitled Confidentiality Agreement, but it included a paragraph 6, which in essence said both parties agree that unless and until there is a definitive written agreement signed by both parties, neither party will have any liability to the other for any words or conduct involving the transaction which was being negotiated. Now, at the beginning, the definition of the transaction that was about to be negotiated was very broad. It was exploring the possible acquisition of part or all of Middleton Motors by Lindquist Ford. Now, as the negotiations began and throughout the negotiations, the transaction always involved two interrelated components. Number one, a cash infusion into the business, and number two, management services to be provided by Lindquist Ford. The court recognized on summary judgment in its decision that the Lindquist Ford never established any facts to show that they were ever separated.
Counsel, this reliance on this confidentiality agreement seems to cover, as the agreement says, there's no liability, quote, by virtue of this agreement or any other written agreement or oral expression with respect to the transaction, close quote. Now, if I understand the district court's decision correctly, no liability was imposed by virtue of any written agreement or oral expression. Liability was imposed by virtue of the fact that Miller actually managed the dealership for 11 months. That is, it was imposed on the basis of conduct rather than communications. How does this paragraph 6 of this confidentiality agreement cover conduct as opposed to communications?
Well, I think the conduct was directly related to the words in the spoken and written words of the parties' negotiations, that it came about because in mid-April of 2003, before Craig Miller ever started work at Middleton Motors, there was a discussion between the parties.
Is there any language in the confidentiality agreement covering things related to oral expressions? It's not what you quoted. What you quoted just covers this agreement or any other written agreement or oral expression.
Yes, but I think that contracts have to be...
Is there some other language
that
I need to read?
There's not
That's
other,
it. Okay.
There's not other language with respect to the confidentiality agreement. The second and independent ground is that under quantum merit under Wisconsin law. The law implies a presumption of fact if one proves that the defendant requested services and that the plaintiff provided those services in response to the request. And the presumption is that there was an agreement that the defendant would pay for those services. Now, the terminology for this is varied among cases. You can find it expressed as quasi-contract, implied in fact contract, implied in law contract. But the essence of a quantum merit claim under Wisconsin law is that there, the law will imply a mutual understanding between the parties that there will be payment, because that is the general understanding in our society, that unless there's situations where one would expect the services to be provided gratuitously, there's a general understanding that there will be payment. Now, it's very clear under Wisconsin law that that is a rebuttable presumption, and it can be rebutted by the words, the conduct, and the course of dealing between the parties. Now, it was clear on the undisputed facts that from the beginning of negotiations and continuing even after the termination of Mr. Miller's services, that the parties always contemplated that compensation for management services would be paid only as a percentage of any profits that Middleton Motors earned. In the beginning, in the middle of April 2003, there was a meeting. Craig Miller, Steve Lindquist, their accountant, Mr. Woodward, and the principals of Middleton Motors, Dave and Bob Hudson, and their accountant, Joe Schwartz. And at that meeting, Steve Lindquist testified in his deposition, and that was included in the summary judgment record. Yes, the discussion was payment for management services would be as a percentage of any profits. And it was under that understanding that Middleton Motors agreed to allow Mr. Miller to start.
Actually, that's the one thing that might be prohibited by the confidentiality agreement. Right? As you say, the terms of the negotiation are completely off limits. The judge is not allowed to look at what the parties were negotiating on. And it sounds like that's exactly what the judge did. The judge took the terms that the parties were negotiating on back and forth and ignored them. And now it's you who are saying the judge should have paid attention to them, but the confidentiality agreement prevents that.
Well, and then under that circumstance, the quantum merit claim should be dismissed, because the quantum merit claim is not just based on the conduct of the parties. There is a presumption in a quantum merit claim from the conduct of the parties that there's a mutual understanding of a promise to pay, but that is rebuttable. You can't assert the liability and then prevent the other party from establishing that the mutual understanding was that there would not be compensation paid on an hourly or salary basis.
Actually, counsel, Wisconsin law is all mixed up in this area, as I'm familiar with it anyway, and it conflates implied in fact contracts, implied in law contracts, quasi-contract, quantum merit, and unjust enrichment. And it's very difficult to make heads or tails of it. And the state Supreme Court has had nothing to say on this subject since 1992. And it appears that Judge Crabb got caught up in that confusion in failing to properly conceptualize these claims before they were tried. And that's, at least from my perspective, a large part of the problem here, is that the parties haven't adequately conceptualized what the claims are that were tried here. And that makes it very difficult to apply both the confidentiality clause and the evidence here, or the elements of each separate claim to the evidence here, as well as the measure of damages, because the measure of damages for a quantum merit claim and an unjust enrichment claim are different, and different pieces of evidence can come in under one theory vis-a-vis the other theory.
Absolutely. I think that much is clear. I think it's clear that Wisconsin distinguishes between a claim for quantum merit and a claim for unjust enrichment.
Under it also distinguishes, if you trace all the cases way, way back to the 1800s between an implied-in-law contract and an implied-in-fact contract. And the theory that you're advancing here under quantum merit is really more of an implied-in-fact contract theory instead of quantum merit, which is an implied-in-law contract theory, which turns on the expectations of the parties, the expectations of the plaintiff in particular, and whether the services were rendered on a gratuitous basis or with the expectation of payment. And that's all.
I agree. And I think the problem is that different terminology has been used for these concepts, and the courts will call the same concept an implied-in-law contract at times, an implied-in-fact contract at others.
Well, let's start with the doctrine then.
All right.
The two claims that survived to trial here, as I understand it, are quantum merit, which is, setting aside all this case law that's very murky, what is that cause of action and what are its elements?
The elements of a quantum merit claim under Wisconsin law, or whatever
we
call it.
What's the general rule? Let's go to the restatement.
Okay. One claim is that the defendant, that Middleton Motors asked for services and that Lindquist Ford provided those services, and that creates a presumption.
No, that's not the general rule. That's in the Wisconsin cases here and there, and that's where the confusion has crept in, because that's a factual evidentiary concept which goes to implied in fact contracts, which this is not that sort of a claim. An implied in fact contract is a contract. A quantum merit claim is not a contract. It's a legal fiction that awards damages under principles of justice.
I think that's where sometimes the confusion comes in. My understanding...
Right, but we've got to sort it all out here.
Sure.
So that's why I'm trying to start
with
doctrine. It's a quantum merit claim. What are the elements? I think you said the defendant requested the services. The plaintiff provided them with the expectation of receiving payment.
Right.
And the measure of damages
is
the reasonable value.
But the cases that talk about those two elements, and I agree, the recovery, the measure of recovery under that is generally the amount that would customarily be paid for the services in the community.
Right, and there's all kinds of problems with the evidence here on that, too.
Sure.
But let's start with the claim.
Right. Now, the cases that talk about those two elements and that measure of damages, those cases talk about a presumption, a rebuttable presumption. So regardless of the terminology they use, they say the law implies a presumption or the law creates a presumption of fact.
That's where I'm suggesting that the Wisconsin case law has gone astray, and perhaps we ought to follow what the general rule is if you trace it all the way back to the cases from the 1800s. Which don't turn on that concept, because a quantum merit claim is, it's a legal fiction that's engaged in to do justice. So there is no contract. You don't have to have a meeting of the minds, even circumstantially proved, or even, that arises by way of a presumption that's rebuttable, et cetera, et cetera. That's all implied in fact contracts, which are contracts.
And I would respectfully submit that the rule as it has evolved and is currently as Wisconsin law involves that rebuttable presumption when we're talking about those elements, that however one describes it in terminology, the rule is that it's only a rebuttable presumption that one would pay the reasonable value as measured by the customary rate in the community, but
did the state Supreme Court in the Ramsey case use that terminology? That's the most recent pronouncement from the state Supreme Court, and I read that case as an effort by the court to distinguish between quantum merit and unjust enrichment. And I don't recall, maybe I missed it, that there was the resurrection of this presumption sort of frolic and detour from the other cases.
Actually, my recollection of Ramsey, and there are a lot of cases, but my recollection is that it distinguishes quantum merit from unjust enrichment. It says unjust enrichment is not an implied contract. That's the elements a person confers a benefit, the defendant has knowledge of the benefit, and the circumstances are such that there should be payment. And as,
but
as
it also describes a quantum merit claim as implied in law.
Implied in law, and I think the Theuerkoff case talks about it in terms of is the law implied.
Theuerkoff was an implied in fact case. It had nothing to do with implied in law,
quasi-contract. I think we have, again, simply a difference in terminology.
No, the difference in the nature of the claim.
Well, Theuerkoff talks about the two elements, request for services, services provided.
That's, it's one of those cases that mixes everything up.
But I think Ramsey says that quantum merit is an implied contract, and it distinguishes between an unjust enrichment under Wisconsin law, which has nothing to do with contract principles. It is a straight restitutionary remedy. It says what's fair under the circumstances. But quantum merit, when they say it's an implied contract, what they mean is it has elements of a contract claim.
But that's not really right as a matter of common law. That's what some of the Wisconsin cases say, and I'm suggesting to you that those cases are wrong.
Well, with due respect, I think that's the latest pronouncement from the Wisconsin
Supreme
Court.
Well, that's
why
I'm asking about Ramsey, because Ramsey doesn't say that, and that's the latest pronouncement. Ramsey sort of sidesteps all of that.
Well, it certainly doesn't overrule cases like Theuerkoff, Wojan, and I think the
Wojan was also an implied-in-fact contract case.
Well, again, I think we get into semantics. I think the import
it really is not just semantics, though, because the claims have different elements. They're conceptualized differently. This goes directly to the nature of what sort of evidence is admissible, which is, you know, a primary part of your appeal here, that Judge Crabb wrongly excluded whole categories of evidence when she tried this case.
Right. And my understanding of Ramsey is what it's distinguishing between is, say, unjust enrichment has nothing to do with contract law. It's not related to contract principles. It is simply a restitutionary remedy that deals with the question of fairness, whereas quantum merit is related to contract principles. It has the joint relationship with contract of the mutual understanding of the parties, and that if they had an actual understanding about compensation, that will supersede the presumption contrary.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Shoemaker.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'd like to try to briefly address this confidentiality agreement and then spend the bulk of our time trying to make heads or tails of the difference between quantum merit and implied contract, which I suspect Judge Sykes has already done.
Probably all went south with Hoffman against Red Owl Stores.
That case is out of here, Your Honor. We lost our promissory estoppel case earlier, so we're not even raising that. On the confidentiality agreement, Judge Crabb's reason for denying summary judgment, dismissing the quantum merit and unjust enrichment claims, I think was actually a little different than what Chief Judge Easterbrook described. I think Judge Crabb's reason for rejecting that argument was based on the clear and unambiguous language of the confidentiality agreement, which related it to with respect to the transaction. And Judge Crabb said with respect to the transaction was clearly defined as relating to acquiring all or a part of defendant's business. And because that was clear and unambiguous, and our claim had nothing to do with acquiring all or part of the defendant's business, it was barred by the clear and unambiguous language. And so all of the stuff Mr. Steichen talked about in terms of what they later talked about and then being intertwined was extrinsic evidence that was irrelevant to the motion for summary judgment. Chief Judge Easterbrook's analysis may be an additional reason why the summary judgment should have been granted. But now, quantum merit, implied contracts in fact, the confusion of the case law, there is some. Our claim was a claim for quantum merit, not a claim for implied contract in fact. We lost our contract case. We could not prove it by extrinsic evidence, by circumstantial evidence. They won their motion to dismiss our case for for breach of contract. Whether it's implied in fact or an express contract, it's out of the case. Unjust enrichment is not a contract claim, nor is a quantum merit claim a contract claim. A quantum merit claim is sometimes called an implied contract in law. But as Corbin on contract says, and as Judge Sykes said, it's really a misnomer. A quantum merit claim is really a legal fiction, and it has its roots in the law of absumpsunt, but I'm not qualified to talk about and prepared to talk about.
Here in Chicago, do we follow Corbin or do we follow Williston, who was from Northwestern?
You follow Wisconsin law, Your Honor, and I think that
right.
Corbin and Williston...
That's where I was going next.
And I think Corbin and Williston are consistent with Wisconsin law. I think part of the problem is the Thoyerthaw case is confusing in this respect. The Thoyerthaw case was a case dealing with an implied contract proved by circumstantial evidence. Quantum merit does not appear in the case until many pages after the discussion of an implied contract. And there the court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, simply said that you, even when you have a contract that's barred by the statute of frauds, you still might have a quantum merit claim. And I'm not quite sure why they used that language in that case, because the case really had to do with an implied contract. And in our particular case, at the beginning of the trial, we made clear we were pursuing a contract in quantum merit claim, and we pointed out that the argument that the defendant was making at the beginning of the trial was confusing the concepts of implied contract and contract and quantum merit, which is sometimes a contract in law. So what is a quantum merit claim? The Wisconsin jury instructions, I think, are helpful, and they essentially say that if you find in good faith the defendant renders services, you may award the reasonable value of such services, being the customary rate of pay for the work in the community at the time the work was performed.
That's the measure of damages, though. What about the elements of the claim? Because we've got a challenge to both the evidentiary rulings on the merits as well as how the damages are measured.
Right. I think the elements of the claim for quantum merit are that if the defendant requests services of the plaintiff and the plaintiff performs them, the plaintiff is entitled to be compensated for those services.
Well, usually there also has to be an expectation on the part of the plaintiff of payment, right? I mean,
that they're not being gratuitous. So, for example, if I came to Mr. Smith and said, Mr. Smith, I would like to cut your lawn today, and I'd like to do that because I just would like the exercise and I'd like to enjoy that, that does not give rise to a quantum merit claim. However, if Mr. Smith and I talk and we say, would you like me to cut your lawn today, and he says, yes, I would, but we don't discuss what I'm going to be paid, I would have a claim for quantum merit.
Right, but that implies that the circumstances surrounding the party's relationship would be admissible on the merits of a quantum merit claim. On the expectation of the plaintiff,
yes.
To the extent that they shed light on the expectations of the plaintiff.
And in this case...
And that was wrongly excluded here?
No. In this case, here's what the evidence at trial was. The testimony of Mr. Miller was on April 17, 2003. The parties had a meeting following his prior discussions about we'd like some help improving our business. And it was agreed at that meeting that you will start acting as our general manager on Monday, April 21st, 2003. And they said, and we'll figure out how you're going to be compensated later. And Mr. Miller began work on April 21st, 2003. And they had all these negotiations, which did not lead to a contract. And the reason they did not lead to a contract, the rule court ruled on summary judgment, was that they never reached an agreement on what would happen when the party's relationship terminated. And so there was no contract, but there was this beginning of Mr. Miller providing services under circumstances in which he was not doing it gratuitously, but he expected to be compensated in some way.
Right. Well, my understanding of the defendant's argument here is that the evidence and surrounding circumstances of the party's relationship suggests that the expectation was that the compensation would take the form of a return on profits, and since there were none, then
Right.
You get nothing.
And that is the defendant's argument, and that's the case of defendants wanting to have their cake and eating it too. That's the defendant saying, if we had entered into a contract, we would have entered into a contract only on terms by which you would be paid if we turn a profit. But that contract was never reached, so it is not relevant to the claim for quantum merit to prove what the contract would have been had there been a contract. That's the problem with the defendant's argument. They successfully, tactically or otherwise, chose to get the breach of contract claim out of the case by proving there was never any agreement between the parties, and most particularly, never an agreement on how Mr. Miller would be compensated if they terminated the agreement.
Well, Mr. Shoemaker, the problem I have is if it was understood that Miller's compensation was going to be figured out later on, why that information about the negotiations isn't relevant to what they were figuring out.
Sure. That would be sort of like our analogy of saying, I'd like to cut your lawn today. We'll figure out it out later on. And then I come and prove my breach of my quantum merit claim and say, I was expecting to get $100 an hour. Or the other party saying, I was expecting to pay $2 an hour. That would be proving what we thought a contract might have been had we reached one. But we didn't reach one. We're not in contract. We're in quantum merit. Mr. Miller started performing services as general manager under circumstances where there was no contract and it was not gratuitous.
But there was an expectation that there would be a compensation rate set.
No, there was an expectation that there'd be some agreement regarding compensation. But not an agreement that it would be purely based on profit, not an agreement that if 11 months into the relationship they decided to terminate it before he could turn a profit, he would be paid nothing. There was no meeting of the minds. There was no contract. So for one party to then come into court on quantum merit and say, but if we had a contract, here's what we would have agreed to, or if we had a contract, here's the only thing I would have agreed to, turns the quantum merit case back into a breach of contract case or a case about what the contract would have been if we'd had one, or what we would have agreed about termination if we had agreed to, which of course we didn't. So I hope I've answered your question, Judge.
What about the measure of damages? Claim, Judge Crabb?
On the quantum merit claim, the measure of damages was, I think as the jury instruction says, the reasonable value of such services being the customary rate of pay. And there was evidence put in actually by defendant's expert's report that somebody who works as a dealer or a general manager of a dealership, of this type of dealership, selling 400 or more cars a year, domestic cars, would make about $150,000 a year. His report had some statistical data from surveys in Wisconsin, from I think the National Auto Dealers Association, and in the upper Midwest, and those were the kinds of evidence Judge Crabb relied on, as well as what they paid their subsequent, the person they hired to replace Mr. Miller, as well as she looked at what consultants were paid an hour and so on, and as to unjust enrichment.
Well, that's we haven't even gotten there yet. But as to that measure of damages and the evidence on that score, did the expert's report break down that average salary according to what was salary and what was a return on profit, as the defendants are arguing here?
Well, no. The testimony was that many times a dealer general manager becomes it based on return of profits. But Judge Crabb noted that here it'd be hard to get somebody to agree to be general manager to be paid at least for his first year based on profits because the company had been losing like $300,000 a year. So she found that to pay Mr. Miller a flat rate of 150 or whatever number she used, the same as they paid the subsequent general manager, was sufficient evidence to prove what they would have had to pay someone else to perform those services.
But was there evidentiary support for that?
Yes.
That figure, though?
Yes.
If the figure was part salary and part bonus, essentially.
Well, there was a considerable amount of testimony of Mr. Neustadt, including on cross-examination, that in this particular case, you would not get somebody to do it on profits alone, and that and these data did not show And Mr. Bayoun was paid $50-some thousand a year based purely on salary alone, not based on any share of profits. So, yes, the answer to your question is yes.
And what was the evidence as to part-time, full-time?
Judge Evans found that he was performing the duty of general manager, and he was performing all of those duties. The question, Mr. Neustadt, his testimony included testimony that sometimes, including himself and his own experience, served as manager of more than one different dealership. And so Judge Crabb specifically addressed, and I remember interrupted my oral argument, the closing argument, to ask about that question of part-time versus full-time, and the argument and the evidence was he was performing all the duties of a general manager, even though he was doing some from Bendorf, Iowa, and so on, but she found he was doing all the duties of a general manager, and whether he's working 80 hours a week or 60 total.
Did Ford Motor Company require a general manager as part of the franchise arrangement?
I don't know that to be a case. I know it's extremely common, and I know that the record doesn't reflect that. As to the measure of damages on unjust enrichment, the measure of damages here is the benefit conferred on Middleton Motors. And the benefit conferred upon Middleton Motors here was Mr. Miller's service as general manager. And so Judge Crabb then looked at, well, what is the value of his service as general manager? And that's why the evidence is very similar here in this case as to being very similar. We might have tried to prove the measure of damages in a different way, by proving the profits they achieved or the reduction in losses. Well, we didn't. Our proof was they had the benefit of a competent, skillful, diligent general manager, and that was the benefit. And Judge Crabb found the value of that benefit to be what you'd have to pay to get a competent, skillful general manager. So that's why the two damages case are very similar. I think, is that the yellow light or the red light? Colorblind.
You've got
1 minute. Okay. So I think that if we sort out the quantum merit implied contract claim, we look at the evidence, we find summary judgment was properly denied as to the quantum merit unjust enrichment claim. It was properly tried as a quantum merit unjust enrichment claim, even though the citation of the district court of thorough thaw does confuse things a little bit. It was tried as a quantum merit claim, and if you look at the motions in limine at the very beginning of trial where I explained we were proving quantum merit, not implied contract, that's very clear. You would find that Judge Crabb's award of damages is sufficiently supported by the evidence, and you would find that Judge Crabb did not exclude any evidence that was relevant to those claims. And for those reasons, the district court's decision should be affirmed.
Thank you very much.
I'm fine.
Thank you. The case is taken under advisement. We'll hear argument.